Blog Talk Radio.
And good evening. Welcome to another edition of Black Belt Wall Street New Africa Business Association. Speaking to you live from Washington, D.C., I am your host, Bilal Mesadiq Bynum, along with my co-host,
Abdul Aziz Shaheed. Assalamu alaikum and greetings to you, my audience, and you, my brother Bilal. How are you?
Also, returning the greetings to you, Brother Aziz. How are you this evening?
Oh, good, good. Alhamdulillah. Doing well, my brother.
Welcome to another
great show tonight.
Welcome to the beginning of Black History Month.
Yes.
Today of Black History Month, we would start our show off, and our title, of course, is Peoples Who Have Lost Their History is Like a Tree Without Roots. And
right.
I thought that was a very appropriate title for us. And, of course, I'm quoting a quote that's coming directly from Marcus Garvey. So, peoples who have lost their history is like a tree without roots. And, of course, after 500 years of being taken away from many, many parts of Africa, African Americans today, even though we're one of the most industrialized Africans on the planet, we know nothing at all about Africa. Nothing at all about where we were taken from, because within the 500 years of being taken and put in bondage and brought to the United States or America, we just after 500 years of, I suppose, almost like it taking a person's mind and using an eraser and like going to a blackboard in school and you just totally erase what the teacher put up for your learning assignment. Well, our learning assignment has been totally erased. And after 500 years, we look like Africans. Everything about us look like Africa, but we know nothing at all about Africa. But we know plenty when it comes to the same slave owners who made us slaves. We know everything about them. As a matter of fact, African Americans today, we are symbolic of white peoples. And that will be our discussion. Part of our discussion for those of you that wish to join in on that discussion. Like I said, it's African American History Month. And during these history months, or during most of the time, but especially during the month of African American History Month, we try to learn as much as we can, but at the same time, how can you be taught something that that has been totally erased from you? That's where we are, African Americans today. We, again, we look like Africans. Everything about us is Africa, but we just don't know anything at all about Africa. And again, like I said, in my opinion, I think we're totally symbolic of white folks. And that's why when we, and I know we are, and I myself, when I heard the opportunity of dual citizenships or doing business in Africa, I find that to be very interesting and very exciting. But at the same time, I wonder, because we are so much and so symbolic of white folks, what is our relationships and how would we be amongst our African brothers and sisters? Because we have this barbaric, because I think we came from barbarians. And I think it was barbarians that have taught us their way of life. And as barbarians, what type of relationships can we build honestly with anybody else other than other barbarians? And I might be taking it a bit far, but when you start talking about enslaving someone, and after five, enslaving someone and becoming filthy rich from having African Americans as no more than the same contraband as the rest of the animals on your farm. The only difference about the contrabands that we were just human contrabands, but nevertheless, we had the same qualities as animals. And a commodity to be bought and sold, and to work the fields that the white man called the black soil. And of course, from the productivity that we produce from that black soil has made these white peoples who enslaved us the richest peoples on the planet today, because of the free labor that they got from their slaves and our productivity. So that's where we are today after 500 years. Like I said, we know nothing but the same thing that our slave owners know. But anything on the outside of what they don't know, then we don't know either. Because, again, our cultural knowledge has been erased. So the when you say African Americans who have lost their history, and we all have lost our history. We're just like a tree without roots. And those are my opening comments, Brother Aziz. And I'll go to you and Sister Sasa, and I'm going to start with you, Brother Aziz. And Sister Sasa, she'll be coming on. I think she's got some guests. But we all have our own, it's open mic, so there's nothing specifically that we have to talk about. And you, the listeners, the same thing. Anything that you may want to inject into this conversation, it's open mic, and we are going to welcome your comments. But at this time, Brother Aziz, I am going to turn it over to you. And we'll go to you, and then we'll go to Sister Sasha, Brother Aziz.
Yes, Brother Love, thank you. Yes, this being Black, greetings to our audience, Sister Sasha. We are...
Greetings, how you doing?
Alhamdulillah. We this month we have a lot of history to share with the world, but, you know, it's a thing where our people should know. We should know our own history, because that's what will enable us to look at things differently than we would from, as you would say, the slave master's mindset. One of the things that I was particularly annoyed by this month is the fact that a number of southern states, as well as some northern states, have almost like forbidden for Black history to be taught, period. Not only this month, but period. And, you know, and I'm saying no one has anything to say about the Jews ongoing and ongoing, talking about their history and how they got messed over. And we all know that everybody had a part in making up in slave trade. Africans, Caucasians, the different slave traders, they all had a part in it. So, you know, for them to say that we should not be able to tell our children and let the world know the continuous atrocities that's being committed to our people, this is what, you know, Black History Month is just a part of talking about our history. This is something we should be talking about all the time. Like, I know some people didn't know, like, talking with another brother and talking about how Black folks have always had money in this country, even during when we came out of slavery. We were able to put our funds together and start accumulating big wealth as a group. Someone we really didn't know, Quincy Jones had a uncle up in Chicago. They were tied in with the gangsters in that back of the day making money, like this guy Bumpy up in New York. Well,
Bumpy
these
Johnson.
Guys, they had money. Thank you, Bumpy Johnson. Thank you, sir. Well, these people, they had big money. Quincy Jones' uncle was a big banker. I mean, these guys are bringing in over $200 million a year, and this is a history. This is a history. It's a program on now, story about Bumpy Jones, Malcolm X, and all those. Some of the things in there, not quite correct, but they're somewhat showing the behavior that was going on at that time, or the camaraderie, I should say, with the brothers protecting one another, even though Malcolm X wasn't into the gangster stuff like they were, you know, trying to keep things clean. But I just wanted to say we've always had money and made it, but it was when we made it, I mean, the Caucasians just come right in and took it from us. Just take it. You can't have, I mean, just come in by force. Just the way they went into Wilmington, Delaware, and a number of other places where you had elected Black officials. And because they didn't want them there, they just went in and run them out with the guns and everything. So these are the type of histories that need to be told. We've got to let these histories out, because our young ones need to know it, but at the same time, the young Caucasian children need to know this. Because I have a feeling that, you know, people act the way they're being taught. And their children, I don't think their children nowadays, but living in a in a world where they don't realize how they got where they are. And if they realize how they got where they are and on top, I think it would be a whole different attitude that they would have towards their parents and their people. They would be ashamed of what has been done to another people. You did all this to these people? And the thing about it is they keep records of this. So Black History Month should be, or if we have any of our listeners listening, they should tell any of the histories that they know about things that happened to black folks, not only tragedies, but a more important part is the intellect that we contributed to America. The intellect that we contribute to America is second to none. And most of the inventions and things that made America great, African Americans not only invented them. We had laws made in this country at one time. We could not own a patent. African Americans could not own a patent. So Caucasian took the patents, that would be the ideas that we had, and they went on and registered them as a patent and a trademark for their own, and they made money off them and still making money off them today. So all of these histories need to be told by our people. We got a lot of great history books out there for our youngins as well as adults to read. One of the first ones that I got a hold of was J.A. Rogers, World's Great Men of Color, but that was the title of it, but it had women in there also, great women in the society. And this is good things to note. It's like a bank vault of gold when you grab these books and read about our histories and what we have done to make America a better place and how we've contributed to it in every aspect of technology, science, as well. Our biggest asset to helping America is bringing America around to some morality, some clean moral behavior. And I hope that what happened in Memphis with the young brother getting killed by those black police officers, I hope it doesn't ruin the Black Lives Matter movement, because a lot of the haters are taking that and saying, well, look at this and look what happened there. And we see, you're talking about black police officers. I mean, white police officers, look what the blacks do to one another. And it's just an ongoing situation we're in. They're trying to make us look like we don't care about one another. So we want to turn all that around during Black History Month and not only show about the bad things happening to us, but show all the accomplishments that we've done in America and made in America. And it's going on right now, and there are a lot of them. And that's what I wanted to start off on tonight, Brother Bilal. And I'll let Sister Shasha come on in and thank you for letting me share that part, brother.
Well, thanks so much, Brother Aziz. And like I said, we'll be coming back to some of the opening comments that we just open up with. But at this point, like I said, we'll go to our director in North Carolina, Sister Sasha Ali. Sister Sasha, it's your turn.
Hey, thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum to everybody. Greetings. This is such a powerful conversation, and I'm glad that we have it. You know, this is a powerful month, Black History Month, and although, unfortunately, it's the shortest month of the year, we're not going to let that limitation limit us from continuing this conversation and inspiring younger people to gain all the knowledge possible about where they've come from, their ancestry, and just how dynamic we are as a people in this country. We often talk about the traumas, right? We often talk about the disparity and the pain that we have endured as a people, and rightfully so, because we need to identify those things to show our fortitude and to show the struggle and how we continue to keep on keeping on, as the old saying goes. But I'd also like to bring to the table a conversation about healing, because as you said from the Marcus Garvey quotes, when you don't know your history has been erased, you're like a tree without roots. So in order to heal and to regain those roots, we have to take steps forward to do that. And my guest tonight focuses on that, and that, and that's what she does for her business. Her name is Itohan Abusuyi. Itohan, are you on the phone?
I am. Greetings, everybody.
All right, awesome. I'm going to introduce you, sis. Itohan Abusuyi is the founder of Healed and Fine. She is a healing facilitator that works with African Americans, Black Americans, Pan Africans, however you want to identify, to break through emotional walls, traumas, wounds, and unresolved issues that often keeps us stuck and unable to move forward in life. And so today I have her, or tonight I have her on the line with us to talk about the missing roots that we have and how that has affected us. So, Itohan, thank you so much for joining in the conversation. We welcome you.
Thank you so much for having me. I just want to make sure that I am. Am I clear?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you so much for having me, Sajda. It's such an honor to be being interviewed by you and being on this radio station. I am so looking forward to this conversation.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for joining us. So you heard some of the conversation we had today, right, this tonight. And so we're talking about making sure that we do not erase our history and constantly fighting for that. In some of the work that you do, how does the erasing of our history impact individuals, Black Americans, in that manner?
So that's really a multi-layered question, right? But I'm going to try to take a little piece of it just illuminate on it just a little bit, okay? We have to understand that the systems that oppress Black people are systems, right? The systems that are deeply entrenched in this country, that is really the foundation of this country. And so there's a saying that goes, the victor gets to write the history, right? And so what has happened is, and what has happened since, Europeans started conquering us as African people globally, is that they have always been the one to write the history, right? And one of the reasons that they're able to do so as successfully as they as able to do is because as African people globally, we are an oral people. Right? The way that our stories continue and the way that the next generations hear our stories have been traditionally through storytelling. Right? And so they have taken advantage of that, the Europeans, and so what they've been able to successfully done is be able to, from that aspect, being able to tell the story the way that is beneficial to them. Correct? And we can go all the way back to what they've done with the Egyptians, right? They have continuously whitewashed them and made us believe that the people that were responsible for building the greatest architecture on the planet, the pyramids, were white, right? Or Arab or whatever they want to say, but we know that that is not true. And so we have to understand that they have within their arsenal, the Europeans, the greatest propaganda machine on the planet, which is Hollywood and the media, right? Mm-hmm. We don't control that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so we don't have the infrastructure in which to tell our stories. But then what ends up happening is, one of the reasons that I'm really, really passionate about the work I do is what ends up happening is because we are not in charge of telling our stories, when the next generation gets here, right, they are then looking upon the other Black people as if, what's going on with y'all? Why are y'all so weak? Why are we doing this or why are we doing that? And then we look at, you know, Black people that live in the hood that are like, you know, young Black boys that are involved in killing each other and stuff like that. We're like, what's wrong with them? They should just like, you know, pull their pants up and do this and do that. And then, you know, all this teenage Black mothers should stop just having babies. And, you know, so we pass this judgment on each other because we don't understand what really happened to us.
Mm,
we don't know
yeah.
what happened to us. And much more importantly, we don't know that what the symptoms of racism and white supremacy looks like. We don't
yeah.
understand that those are the last three things I just listed are symptoms of racism and white supremacy, right? And so
yeah.
that's just a little tidbit. That's why it's really important for us to really be able to control our own stories. Like, we have to have infrastructures to control our story so that we're able to tell the truth. And not just that, that we're able to educate, you know, black children, black mamas, black daddies about truly not just what happened to us, but really on an academic level, what the systems of racism and white supremacy really is.
Wow.
Because
so you're
without
saying...
us under...
No, okay. So you were saying that in addition to awareness and knowledge, right, which we identified
mm-hmm.
is necessary,
mm-hmm.
we have to
mm-hmm.
be able to be confident in telling our story in addition to knowing it. We have to tell it, right, because that's power in that. Am I understanding you?
Before we can tell it, we have to know it. And before we can know it, we have to understand what ails us. We don't understand what ails us. And if we don't understand what ails us, we can't heal from it.
Mm.
And what ails us, not just in this country, in the U.S., what ails us, but globally, across all of Africa's children, what ails us is racism and white supremacy. And that's the system
right.
of racism and white supremacy, right?
And
so what has been happening is that we're chasing our tails by really kind of like dealing with this stuff just like on a surface level. Yes, it is very important that we tell our story, but I feel like we tell our story in a superficial way. I don't really feel like we understand, you know. We don't really understand
yeah.
the magnitude or the depth to which we need to go in telling our story.
Mm-hmm. When
you
say
guys understand what
the
I'm saying?
Global, yeah, yes, of course. You mentioned the global commonality of with all Africans across
mm-hmm.
the diaspora, across the world, of white supremacy
mm-hmm.
and racism.
Mm-hmm.
So from what I'm hearing is that is a unifying element with us and the Africans and the Caribbeans and those who are of African descent living in Europe and other parts of the world. Brother Bilal mentioned in the beginning, he was like, you know, if we were to connect with our African brothers and sisters, do we know how to receive them because we were raised and conditioned by barbarians? You are of direct African descent. You're Nigerian.
Mm-hmm.
If you are able to, can you speak to that question that he had? How would Africans receive it, or how do Africans receive us knowing that we had that unifying struggle of white supremacy and colonialism and racism?
So the beautiful thing about African people globally, and when I say African people globally, I'm talking about all of Africa's children, right? I'm talking about Africans on the continent of Africa and Africans. People in the U.S., Americans, because I just feel like America is such a loaded ugly word to me, so I hate labeling. I hate labeling us African Americans, but I guess for the purposes of this conversation, if I say Africans, I'm speaking about Africans globally. If I want to make a distinction about where I'm talking about, then I will make that distinction, okay? Just so you guys can follow me. And just for a point of view, I'm a Pan African, so wherever my people are, so I don't separate Africans at all. I feel like our struggles are the same. Of course, the specifics of the struggles are regional, right? Well, black people in the U.S. face in particular is very different, can be different, slightly different from what black people in the Caribbean face and then black people on the continent face, right? But the underlying trauma that connects us is, you know, whiteness, and we have to understand that. And so how do Africans, you know, receive, you know, Africans in the diaspora, not just Africans from the U.S., but Africans from the Caribbean, Africans from Europe, and Africans from, you know what I mean, all over North America and stuff like, you know. The beautiful thing about us as African people globally is that we're such a compassionate and welcoming people, right? And that we know we don't meet strangers. which is a beautiful thing because we're very connected to earth, we're very connected to nature, we're connected to people. It's a beautiful thing, but it's also how the European was able to enslave us, right? Because we welcomed him in,
yeah.
And then we were showing him the way of the land. We were showing him, we're like, well, look at this pale-skinned, sickly thing. What in the world? Let's take him in and, you know, do all the things that we do as African people. So it's backfired. So the short and answer is that when Africans from the diaspora go to the African continent, they are always welcomed so warmly, so graciously, right? And we have to understand a lot of Africans on the continent really have little to no clue about transatlantic slavery, right? That's really very, very sketchy because it's not taught. It's not taught on the African continent. You know what I'm saying? There are some parts of the continent that they have a deeper knowledge of it than others, but by and large, it's typically not something that is talked about or known. You know, for example, I'm going to tell you this. For example, my father, who's Nigerian, my father told me a story about my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, right? And he was this great medicine man, as the story goes. And so one day he left the house and never came back, And so the story was told, and this is what the entire family believed, that he was so powerful that spirit took him up, like he just ascended into the heavens, right? My father said it wasn't until he came to the U.S. that he realized, oh, he must have been captured and kidnapped and enslaved, right? And so that's just if you can just imagine that, right? Imagine that. And so it's not taught. So when we go back to the continent of Africa, like to visit, all of the stories that I have heard, that I have witnessed has been, you know, Africans just welcoming Africans from the U.S., Africans from the Caribbean, Africans from, you know, just globally, because we are a welcoming, we are such a warm people. And there's some parts of the African continent that they actually have, like, ceremonies and stuff to welcome you back home, like, welcome back home, my child, welcome back home. For example, when Malcolm X went to Nigeria, he was given the name Amawale. Amawale is a Yoruba name, meaning child has come back home. Do you understand what I mean? And so I don't know if that answers your question, Sajda, but that has been my experience of what Black people's experience in going back to the continent has been like.
It does. It does answer. I can definitely attest to what you're saying. I've been to the continent several times. I've been to the Caribbean, and that definitely is the energy. That is the attitude. That is the genuine spirit of the people. They just welcome you back. They just welcome you back. And they want to share with you what you've missed. And for those who are educated about our history, even more so, they want to share it even more so. And so making that connection, I think that where the disconnect may come from is when they come to America and then they have to assimilate and get reconditioned to the Western way of this country and how cold and bitter it is, and something that we have, you know, lived in since the beginning of enslavement, and it's and I've seen the change of those who are from their homeland on the continent and then come to the United States, and it's that disconnect may happen at that point.
So let's touch on that really quickly, if that's okay. Can we talk about that really quickly?
Sure.
So one of the things that happens with Black people globally is that we have to understand the systems of white supremacy and racism governs every facet of Black life, right? Every single facet of Black life is governed by the systems of racism and white supremacy. So I'm talking about religiously, I'm talking about familially, I'm talking about romantically, I'm talking about culturally, I'm talking about socially, right? I mentioned the propaganda machine, which is Hollywood and the media, right? And so we have to understand there was a mandate by the CIA, right, decades ago, that one of the top priorities for them was to disassociate Black people from the U.S. from the continent of Africa. They wanted to keep a very, very tangible division between black people from the U.S. and continental Africans. Do you guys hear that? And so what they had to do in order for that to be successful is they had to engage in a series of movies and programming to keep us separate. Do you understand? And so what they did is that they sent over just so many, like, you know, movies and programming about black people in the U.S. over to the continent of Africa, things that were very negative, things that were very, you know, the pimps and the whores and the thievery and all of the, you know, all of the stuff that white America imagines that black people are or want to say that we are, right? So they sent all of those imageries and programming to the continent of Africa, okay? Wow. They did the opposite with us here in the U.S. is that they showed us things like Tarzan. They showed us things like starving Ethiopian children, things like Africans living in huts and Africans living, you know what I mean, among animals and all of those things. So they were able to control the imagery and how we saw each other. And so when the continental Africans started coming to the U.S., they're like, oh, I don't want to be a part of them. Because this is what I know of them. Do you understand?
Yeah.
This is what I know of them. You know, and not all continental Africans, I'm not going to even put that on there, but the experiences that a lot of black people talk about when they say, you know, when, you know, Africans come over here, and they use the word Africans loosely, you know, when Africans come over here, you know, they don't like, you know, black people from the U.S., but then Africans also say about black people from the U.S., well, they look down on us. They think they're better than us. You know what I'm saying? So we have those two experiences, and I think that we cannot talk about one without talking about the other. And they're both birthed from the same intentional programming.
That's amazing information.
Huh?
I said that's amazing information that we were not aware of.
Absolutely.
How
African
the
unity
propaganda
is,
was on the other side as well.
Absolutely. African unity, and when I say African unity, I'm talking about African unity across the globe, is the number one threat to white supremacy and capitalism. Because once we realize as African people globally that we are one and that we are oppressed by the same systems, then the paradigm changes. It shifts. Because then we understand, first of all, we are not a minority. We are not a minority, right? And so then we understand, oh, we have comrades in struggle, and a comrade in struggle looks like you.
Yeah.
And they are across the whole globe, not just on the continent of Africa, but we're talking about South America. We're talking about Central America. We're talking about the Caribbean. We're talking about all over Europe. That blackness is the majority. And that all those black people are oppressed by the same systems?
Right now, for those who are just tuning in, we are talking to the founder and owner of Healed and Fine, Ms. Itohan Abusuyi, who is a professional healing facilitator. And we're talking about the wounds and the trauma of white supremacy and the history of slavery. And the conversation is becoming just so dynamic right now as we learn more and more about how propaganda and white supremacy has deep rooted in the pain and the trauma that we have faced, because we're also dealing with the stages of healing. And so that brings me to my next question with you, Ms. Itohan. So with all that you said, with that, now that we have that understanding and that knowledge, how does healing begin? I know you mentioned we need to have a true understanding of our history, not just a baseline, a true understanding. And from that true understanding comes awareness, then we're able to act. What are some of those actions that you facilitate in your business to help African Americans, Black Americans come to a point of healing through their trauma?
One of the things that I feel like is really important for us to understand is that the black family has always been the stabilizing force in the fight for Black liberation. It has always been the backbone of Black liberation. It's always been our foundation as African people globally, and that's one of the reasons why so much was done to destabilize the Black family and essentially, you know, weaken the Black family, removing the Black men from the household, right? And so what I am really concerned about the Black family and what our children, bless their hearts, how they are crying out for that stabilizing force, right? Because that is no longer there. And so I feel that the first step has to be that we understand the systems of racism and white supremacy. That's always going to be the vantage point to which I do my work. And when we hear that as Black people, we're like, oh, we don't understand what racism is, but we don't. We understand it intuitively. We understand that something is racist. We understand that, okay, that's racist. That you know, they didn't do this, or they followed me in the store, or they said this to me, or they fired me because I was Black. We understand that. But we don't understand it on an academic level. And I feel, and I know that until we start understanding these systems academically, right, until we have curriculums to actually teach every Black woman and child what is really going on, we are not going to change behaviors. And the behavior and the social conditioning is what has to change for Black people. We don't need white folks to do a doggone thing for us. We don't need to let them tell us.
Right.
We don't need them to tell us our history. We don't need them to do a doggone thing for us. We'll pay back what they owe us, and we got the rest.
Right.
But what we have
to
be responsible for doing is changing the conditioning of our people. Your oppressor has no, I'm going to say this three times, your oppressor does not benefit from teaching you what he has done to you. He does not. Your oppressor does not benefit from teaching you what he has done to you. Your oppressor does not benefit from teaching you what he has done to you. Power, it does not concede easily. If you want power, you're going to have to take it. For some reason, we think that revolution is going to be easy. It is not. It is not easy. It is not pretty. You can't put a bow on it. White people are not going to wake up one day and concede power and be like, you know what? We've been so horrible to y'all Negroes. Let's give y'all some power. That's not going to happen. What has to happen is that we have to understand exactly who they are as a people. They have shown us who they are for centuries. We keep not getting the message. Because somehow, somewhere, we think that they have a soul, and one day they're going to wake up and be like, oh, my gosh, how horrible have we been? That's never going to happen. That's never going to happen. And the sooner we realize that, the better it's going to be for us. Because then we can understand that, oh, liberty and liberation and revolution is totally up to us. Now, what systems are we going to put in place to make that happen so that the next generation is not sitting down having the same conversation that we're having right now, that we've been having for the past how many decades, because we keep waiting for the change to happen with white people. So what do we need to do? We need to learn about the systems of racism and white supremacy on an academic level. We need to have our greatest thinkers put together curriculum and programming, different sorts of media programming that's actually going to be going into the hands of every Black household. And then through that vantage point, then we can understand why it is that we do the things that we do. Because the things that we do are as a result of the conditioning and the programming of racism and white supremacy. And it has to start with rebuilding the Black family, the Black woman, the Black man, the Black child.
Wow. We're having dynamic conversation right now. The lines are open. Q&As are welcome.
anyone, please get on and let's continue this conversation with Ms. Itohana Basui and also the host. Talk about healing the Black family and identifying our roots. Let's keep the conversation going.
Ms. Apasui, I hope I pronounced it correctly.
It's okay, brother. yes, I can hear you.
And sister, I want you to know that your conversation is so welcome. And like I said, this is the reason why we started our program with Black History Month, because we need to share as much information with each other as we possibly can, because of so much of what we've lost, and in many cases we can say we never had. But I need to ask you, when we start talking about liberation and my question to you, were you in this country in 1965? I guess I just heard you say no. I have a reason for asking. I have a reason for asking you that.
I wasn't born in 1965. I wasn't born yet.
Okay.
I was still incubated in the ether somewhere.
I was, and of course, Brother Aziz, my co-host, he was also.
Yes, yes.
Sister Aisha, she were also. Saying that to say, we came from segregation. We came from Jim Crow. We came from so many laws that would dehumanize a Black person, and we was raised being dehumanized all of our life until... And I use 1965 because that's when we showed our success. But what success are we talking about here? Like I said, we came from segregation. We came from Jim Crow. It made no difference whether you was a Democrat or a Republican. As a matter of fact, we came during the time where the Ku Klux Klan ran this entire country. So again, what stopped that powerful, and like Brother Aziz was talking about a few moments ago, Malcolm X and some of the other great leaders that you heard of, and I myself open up with the program, and of course you are talking about Marcus Garvey, and of course, our title goes back to peoples who just simply lost their history. During the time of Black Belt, the Black Belt business district, which was started by Booker T. Washington back in the 1910s, that particular Black Belt is what started Marcus Garvey and financed Marcus Garvey. That particular Black Belt business district is what started the migration, taking Black folks from sharecropping and where they couldn't make a dime throughout the South. They could only be slaves because of they couldn't pay their sharecropping bills year after year after year. Those bills would go up higher than what their debt started out to be. Surcharges was always added as to where they just couldn't pay to get out of sharecropping. And what got and like I said, it was the power of business, Black business folks, such as the Black Business District and Black Wall Street, that was able to finance, and of course, with all that oil, and stuff that was generated that African Americans actually own. And, of course, we know the story of Black Wall Street as to where they went in and just total destruction. My thing is that we went through all of these destructions, and until we as young folks that started the Black Panthers movement, the Black United Fronts, many of us are doing our young adult years was revolutionaries. And during those revolutionary times, I can't say that we was at war, but it was the closest time in America's history that the white folks realized we was really ready to die and take our freedom. The Civil Rights Bill that was passed in 1965 was not given to us. We took that bill. We took it because there was a thing that most of the cities in this country was burning. And not saying we defeated white power, but we went up against it directly. Everything about us, we did directly. So this is where, because even during that time, the word African Americans, we didn't know anything about being African Americans until Malcolm went to Africa and came back and told us we was no longer Negroes because we thought we were Negroes. So this is the what I mean about having a history, losing your history, and trying to grow into a people of knowledge. But that knowledge that we have, again, was knowledge of white folks. But even with that knowledge of white folks, we took our own Afrocentric ways of life, and we tried to be as close to what we could imagine being Africans as we possibly could. So that this business of African Americans and Black is beautiful, this was a living symbol for us. It was a proud mm-hmm. symbol. And we took, and during the 1965, when the Civil Rights Bill was passed, they was passed because, again, we exerted our own powers, and that was a power of being revolutionaries. I would say, and I experienced this myself, and I think about it many times, we lived so well from 1965 until around in the late 70s. We lived so well, and there were so many advantages given to us, like EEO, the Office of Economic Opportunities. All of this was opening up. Black folks was taken out of service jobs now and going into the civil service jobs, going into administrative positions, going to college. Myself, there were so many opportunities for black folks during the time of this revolutionary stand that we took, and right on up until the late 70s, and I keep mentioning the late 70s because I remember going back to those times, and things were so wonderful in this country during that time until African Americans was actually saying, and I can remember African Americans saying, there was no more racism in this country. This is how well many of us, especially your parents, this is why you see many of your parents having some well-advanced jobs, well-advanced education, because this is the advantages that we took for ourselves, and we grew mm-hmm. very well economically. We bought you guys up, I would say now, your generation, mm-hmm. because I would, and we bought you guys up, and you can see how your mode of living was much different from our mode of living. And, of course, that continues to go even today. African Americans, those who can show success, have a very good mode of living. My question to you is that not so much a question. That is your generation on up until today's generation of African Americans. You went to integrated schools. You went to, and those integrated schools started somewhere in the 80s. That's why I use the 70s, where black folks hollered. There was no more racism from the times that our revolutionary movements made it seem so. But at some point, the next generation that went to these white schools, our kids that went to these white schools, were taken away from us. They could not learn the Afrocentric things that motivated us as a people and unified us as African Americans. And this unification went on all over the Caribbean and everywhere. Black is beautiful, and so forth and so on. But at some point it died out, and it died out with our generation, and then the kids that you had during your generation, and I would even say maybe you guys may even be grandparents now, and it would be the kids of your kids' generations. Black is beautiful, and the unity of being black simply died out. As a matter of fact, most of these kids, and I've spoken to some of them, and I call them kids even at age 30 and 35, because they know nothing at all about even what we as African Americans that are still alive, they know nothing at all about our achievements. As a matter of fact, many of them don't even know who Dr. Martin Luther King is, because, again, everything they learned is 100% of what white folks have taught. And I was speaking to some of the black educators here on the radio some times ago, and some of these educators, African-American educators, are telling me that today only 10% of the national teachers population are African-Americans. The rest of the 90% or so like that our kids are being taught by white folks. So again, like you said, we white folks are not going to teach us what is good for us as African Americans. Are they only going to
absolutely not here?
How to be, and I am going to give it over here. How to be symbolic of what they are. So when you start talking about the systems, and I'm not saying necessarily you, but African Americans, when you start talking about a disaster, and that's one of the things we talk about in our programs, Sister Ali, and I think she's under the weather tonight, but African Americans suffer. And they have to be suffering. All of them have to be suffering. And they've been suffering for hundreds of years from post-traumatic stress, PTSD. Mm-hmm. I can't mm-hmm. see how they cannot be suffering from it. And
absolutely.
So, again, so this thing about the situation where we are asking for this, are we waiting on white folks to do that? No. We've already showed, but again, too, I say we've already showed because most of us are in our senior years now. If I may, can I interrupt, interject?
And so, and I should have, I always start every conversation by, because this is a radio show, I didn't get a chance to do it, by saying and acknowledging what our ancestors and our elders have done for us, right, as a race of people. Much blood has been shed in order for us to have a modicum of freedom that we have in the U.S. and globally, as African people globally. And so I always just show, honor and gratitude and thanks to my elders and my ancestors for the things that, for the sacrifices that you all have made and the ancestors have made for us to be where we are right now. But part of the things that we have to do as African people globally is that we have to learn, we have to be able to dissect history and tactics and be able to fully have a good discourse on tactics and techniques and liberation tactics that actually worked and the ones that didn't work. And the ones that didn't work, we need to dissect them and figure out, okay, what happened, right? And so me saying everything that I say does not in any way, shape, or form negate my deep knowledge and appreciation and the utmost respect that I have for the fight that you all did and the ancestors did for us. But I do understand as a student of history, and I do understand as somebody that does this work, that there are some things that worked for us and there's some things that did not work. Yes. Did we have with the information that we had, decades ago, we did the best that we could. But I would argue, and a lot of us would argue, that integration actually is the cause of all of those things, brother, that you're just saying is happening. The reason that my generation does not know and is not carrying on the baton of liberation and black power is because our parents raised us like white children. And I understand why they did that, because they wanted us to have the freedom to be whatever we wanted to be, right? They wanted us to have the full meaning of being an American, that you can be whoever you want to be, and you can have all the freedom, and you had no constraints, no restraints on being the full human being that you can be. And so I understand that as a parent now, I understand the need for your parents to want you to have that. Right? How did that serve us, though, as African people in the U.S.? Did that serve us? No, it did not. Because the result of that has been that now my generation and our children know nothing about the struggles, know nothing about our history. We are not even able to carry on the history, the traditions, or nothing, because that has been whitewashed, that has been watered down, because we do believe that there's no more racism. So every time something happens, like the unfortunate slaying and assassination of that young brother in Memphis, Tennessee. Every time something happens, we are shocked that, oh, my God, there's still racism in this country. You're doggone right, there's still racism in this country, right? But the reason that we have been lulled into a false sense of security is because integration did not work. That does not mean that we don't appreciate the sacrifices and the blood and the lives that were shed in order for us to be integrated. But as African people, we have to be able to understand the tactics of war, right? And be able to really assess what worked and what did not, and what can we improve. But how can we improve it so the next generation is not sitting having the same conversation that we're having right now? But all honors and praises and gratitude is always given to the elders and the ancestors for the fight and the struggle that they did in order for me to even be on this radio station, spouting all this intellectual mumbo jumbo. You know what I'm saying? That they didn't have to have, So, yeah.
Sister, and what I find sort of frightening from what we both are saying is that as seniors, we can't carry that baton anymore. We got to pass it on to your generation and the generation beyond you. And I must say,
absolutely,
I'm not for sure if you are ready to to receive it, because again, it's almost like your generation all has got to go back and do a battle all over again, because from what we did, everything has weakened itself. And we are the ones that caused that weakening, because we didn't teach our younger generation wasn't interested really in being black folks.
Well, no, I think that you guys, with all due respect, you guys have to take some responsibility for that. I don't think you taught us. I don't think you taught us that. I don't think you taught us what it means to be black and how you have to hold on to that blackness and be proud of it. I think that integration, once integration came, we got lulled into a false sense of security as black people. And we can understand that. We can understand that from our vantage point. But I think in order for us to be able to do what you're saying, it's often sometimes frustrating for my generation and the generation after me to hear our elders say we weren't interested or we didn't pick it up. No, I don't think that your generation taught it to us. Like I say, you guys raised us to be like white people. You guys,
you know,
Very good point, sister, and a very good point. I'm gonna pass it to you in just a quick second, Isaiah. Sister, very good point, because I guess I said that to say, how do we unite still? Because, I mean, let's face it, our generation, even though we're older, we're still walking on top of this earth. Excuse me. And we can still share information with the younger generation. So any values that we have, we can certainly pass it on to our younger generation. So, yes, the responsibility could be we could be somewhat irresponsible, but like we both know, when it comes to information, it's not easy for African Americans to spread their information with each other, because we don't have the communication channels.
Infrastructure. Yeah, we don't have the infrastructure. Yes, absolutely.
Not at all.
Before the brother interjects really quickly, I think the short answer, brother, is how can we pass on that information to young people? The short answer is that we stop looking down on young people and what they don't know. We take responsibility for what we didn't teach them, and then we start the conversation, and we say, we know, we dropped the baton. We know we did this because of these things, and this is what we're ready to do right now. Because one of the reasons that young people are alienated from the elders is all that pointing the finger and y'all generation, y'all doing this and y'all doing that, without the previous generation saying, you know what, if y'all doing that, it's because we didn't teach y'all. And we got to take responsibility for that, for not teaching y'all. So now here we are, humbly coming before you as your elders and saying, we are ready to pass on the information and the knowledge that we have so that your generation can do better.
Point well taken, sister. Well taken. Let me just say, not only our mics, I've opened our mics up to all of our listeners. So anyone who is can hear us speaking, at this point, we can hear you. So we welcome your comments, and we ask you to share in. Again, this is Black History Month. Our mics are open.
Yes, my name is Brother Aziz, and what I wanted to comment on, first of all, was I wanted to thank the sister for sharing the information that she's sharing with us, because it's very valuable information that she's sharing, especially when a lot of people don't know the structure of things. They know what it looked like on the outside, but they don't know what it's composed of on the inside, what it's made of. And I appreciate her sharing some of the structure of how this racism is set up, not the common things we see, like she say, you know, I didn't get the job because, you know, I was black, and all types of other discriminatory things that we know of, which that would cause us, you know, to not know why things are coming down at us like it like it's coming at us. Secondly, I wanted to say, with things being like that, in order to carry the banner on and to put the same thing into your children that you got, it was not a stopping point. There were certain institutions in our African-American community that taught to their captive audiences. They taught them to not only forgive, not forget, but don't harp on the past. Look to the future and dream. Your mind can fly above the clouds, and all this can fly above the clouds. So here comes people that are considered by the oppressor, as well as those that's trying to make a change out of these institutions. Well, they say, well, these people are militant. Oh, it ain't like that. Why do y'all keep talking about that? That is how the torch got dropped. There were institutions in our community that taught that kind of philosophy, that kind of mentality, that type of psychology.
Absolutely.
That's how the torch got dropped. It wasn't that a number of us just dropped it like that. And I'm not saying, but I'm saying that's how it was dropped. Mm-hmm. I'm agreeing with you, sister, and I was just adding to the structure of how it was dropped.
Absolutely. I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. Yes, you're right.
And, you know,
the pacification.
Church. Yeah.
But
the
it's part of it.
Had a lot
it's
to do
the pacification. The pacification of the Negro.
Yes.
Absolutely. It was actually a tactic. Yes, absolutely.
Yes, you know. So it was that psychology that was being used, and I was saying when you were giving us this information on this structure of how it's set up, the psychology structure, not the physical structure that we see. Happening to people now, but the psychology structure, that is very important. That is so important. It's like if you don't know that, then these other things will just keep happening and happening, and you'll turn great.
And we just keep chasing our tails. Absolutely, yeah. There's a great historian by the name of Neely Fuller. Neely Fuller said, if you don't understand the systems of racism and white supremacy, everything that you think you know will always confuse you. And that is the state of black people globally. We are confused because we don't know what ails us. And we don't understand that there's a war that's been waged on black people, and this war has been going on for centuries.
Yeah.
And so we think that the people who are at war with us, we are not at war with them. But it doesn't matter if you want to engage in war or not. If there's war being waged against you, you're going to have casualties.
Yeah.
Exactly, and the struggle continues with that understanding and that awareness. As we continue a conversation, the lines are open. Questions, comments, join in. This is a powerful discussion that just ignites the first day of Black History Month. For those who've lived quite a long time, and I'm sure as those on the call tonight, we've seen Black History Month go from year to year to year, and it's the same story, the same, only five people are identified as historians or, you know, Black History icons, but we need to go deeper, and that's what this conversation is doing. And we have the founder and the owner of Healed and Fine, Ms. Itohan Abusuyi, who is a healing facilitator, and we're engaging in these tough conversations. So please join in. Questions, comments. Let's have this conversation.
And make certain the sister makes a sheet. Leave her information for anyone who needs she can look forward to if she would like all the information as to where we can and you can be able to get in touch with her organization. So our mics are open and we do welcome your conversation.
Hello.
Hi
there. I have a question. This is such an amazing
Oh, I'm enjoying the conversation. I did get in the conversation late, but I got in and I was immediately excited and hyped about what I was hearing. My question would be to the sister, can you tell me, because now we have, I have children that are in their young adults at this point. They've finished college, but they're still young. And I did a lot to kind of instill in them some of my history. But can you give any suggestions and ideas of how we can start to heal ourselves, you know, with everything that we've been through as a people? Is there any tips or suggestions or ideas that you can give to us that we can try to help our children, you know, at this point?
Yes, absolutely. Great question. Thank you. And I'm assuming that question is for me, Itohan?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And so one of the things that I did with my son as I was raising him is that I never waited till something happened in the culture to have a conversation with him. It was an ongoing conversation that I had with him about who he was as a black person, who he was as an African boy in this world that's ruled by the systems and his whip. Because it was very important to me that he did not internalize his oppression, right? And that he did not grow up to be a man that, you know, acquiesced and deferred to whiteness. So one of the things that we have to do as families totally is that we need to start having family meetings. Like once a month, once every 2 weeks, in which we actually help our children, our loved ones, to deconstruct racism and white supremacy. Like deconstruct it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what has happened this past few weeks. What has happened to you? Why does that happen? Let's talk about what you saw on TV. Like watch programming together with your children and help to deconstruct the many messages that are being passed down to our kids about their inferiority, right? Sometimes we watch, oftentimes, because I know I annoy my family and friends because I'm always deconstructing racism and white supremacy. They're like, dang, can we just watch the show without you doing all that? No, we cannot. Because propaganda is being sent to you day in and day out. And whether you're, as I said before, I don't care if you understand or you are engaged in war. In the war, if war is waged against you, there's going to be casualties. And so we have to understand that. And so part of what we have to start doing now, to your question, sister, is this. Have family meetings in which you are deconstructing programming and racism with your children, with your loved ones, so that they are able to understand what is happening. It's not because I am black. The problem is not me. The problem is them. And then you want to give them tools to empower them so that when that happens again, they're able to, you know, be empowered and stay empowered. You know, one of the things that I always say that we do as black parents is this conversation that we have with our children about police encounters, right? And how, and this is going to be a very sensitive one because, of course, we just lost a young man in Memphis, Tennessee. But one of the things that we do as black people in the U.S. is, and it only happens in the U.S. because America is the most violent country on the face of the earth, right? It was built on violence. So, and this is what separates black people living in America from other black folks living all over the world, is that we tell our black boys, you are a king, you are a warrior, you know, you can be whoever you want to be. You can be whatever you want to be, except when you come across cops, especially white ones. Then you got to say yes, sir. Then you got to, you know, don't make eye contact. Then you got to, you know, defer and acquiesce to whiteness. Then you got to do all of this shucking and shuffling and shuffling and not being a man because, you know what, I want you to come home. And I understand as a mother, I understand. Of course we want our boys to come home. Of course we want our boys to come home. But it's such a dichotomous messaging that we give to black boys. One, that you're a king and you're a warrior, and then two, you got to defer to whiteness. We can't have those two things in the same vessel. And so we have to start changing and deconstructing those messages so that our children remain empowered regardless of what they encounter outside of our purview. How does that look? And so that is what deconstructing racism and white supremacy is. You just cannot let your children watch shows and programming without you helping them to deconstruct what it is that they're seeing and the messages that are trying to indoctrinate them with. Do you understand? I hope that answers your question.
It does, and I think that you're spot on with so many things that you said in that conversation, and it reminded me of a conversation when a lot of stuff was going on as far as with, you know, the police and our black men going on, and I remember my 26 or 27 at the time, year old son coming to me and saying, "Mom, you know, I'm looking at these videos of people just standing around and they're recording and they're watching these men, you know, do this." He's like, "And I can't do that." He's like, "I'm letting you know that I will not be able to do this because of the way you raised me." He said, "I would have to see if other brothers or I would have to try to intervene, even if it means me getting hurt or harmed or going to jail. I'm going to have to intervene. I can't just stand around and do nothing and just record." He's like, "I can't do it." And that's what I thought of when you said that, you know, just a minute ago. And like, everything you said, I'm so on top of
kudos
it. I appreciate
to,
it.
Kudos
so
to
much.
You. Kudos to you and kudos to him for being a warrior. Because
wow.
That's what we need.
Yes, yes.
That's what we need. And that's how my son is as well. That's how my
yeah.
son is. I just can't stand around mom and just watch that and record that. No. No, I'm not going to watch another black man be hurt and killed and just stand there and record. And that is what we need to raise our boys. Our boys are warriors. If they're warriors, let them be warriors. You know, let them be warriors. And this is what we need. And this is why I was saying to the brother earlier on, we appreciate all of the work and the sacrifices that you guys have done. We appreciate that. But lives were lost in this fight for liberation. Lives were lost. And liberation
yeah.
and revolution does not come easy. It's not pretty.
Right.
It's not pretty. And we have to be willing to sacrifice and stuff. And so what can we do as a race of people right now? Those are the types of conversations that we need to start having with our children and our families in order to help deconstruct racism and fortify and empower them to deal with this system, because these systems are not going anywhere. Capitalism is founded on racism and white supremacy. It's not going
yeah.
anywhere.
No.
Yeah.
You know, sister, just to add on to what you're saying, and I notice, and even in my own family, our younger folks, especially throughout their time in school, starting from grade school right on through high school, and I would say from the age right on up until they are just around 18, when they become young adults. And at that point, they graduated, let's say, from high school. And what does that mean? That means that, and I was talking to some of my younger folks about this, that means that when they graduate from high school or when they become 18 years old, they have never really experienced racism. During the time that they were coming up in junior high school, grade school, and you can see how well the young folks integrate with each other. They they do everything together. They party together. Everything is just done as to where they all love each other.
Brother, can I interrupt you for a second? That is not true. That is an illusion that we have.
Again,
they experience racism and white supremacy every day in the school system. They experience it every day.
Again, I am going to give you my opinion and my assessment.
Okay.
Of what I have
okay.
dealt with. I'm not saying that this is the reality. This is just an African-American who have dealt with this, because I don't know the answer to this. But I can say, like I said earlier, during our generation, we became united with each other all over this country and we was coming from the hardest of segregation. But now the kids today, and like I said, our younger ones were raised right on up until about 18. They do not realize, very few of them realize anything about being black. And like I was saying a few moments ago, most of them don't even know who Martin Luther King is. But once they become around 18 years old, and like I said, they become independent black folks now, independent young adults, and that's when most of them come to older generations, older folks in the family like myself, and that's when they start talking to us because they're realizing that I am an adult. Once you become an adult, you're no longer a part of that young folks' innocence ways of life. You are a black adult now. And now that you're a black adult, you're not only realizing you're living racism. You're a part of it, but it's a shock to you because like the young lady was saying and like many are saying, our kids just didn't realize what racism really was until it was right on top of them. And now, what do I do about it? Now, this is my opinion. So, again, I'm sharing that opinion. I think that most of our young folks just don't know anything about racism until they become adults. And when they become adults, it's almost like it's too late because and many of them get in a lot of trouble because they think things are so innocent, so freely given to them. They can do just about anything white folks can do. And they get into a lot of trouble because they try to integrate with white folks at an adult age. And that's when the reality of racism really hit them. So that's my opinion. And like I said, our mics are open, and I look forward to everybody else sharing their opinion. Go right ahead, sister. I'm turning it back over to you.
To me?
Yes,
Ms. Hoheim?
If you wish to comment.
Yes, you can.
Okay, so what I was saying is that they do experience racism, they just don't have the language for it because I think that we think because they are integrated, there's the integration, the classrooms are integrated, but they do experience racism every day. Because we've raised them or our parents raised us not to use the language called racism, we say so many different things now. All of these benign words. We have people of color. We have this multiculturalism in the school system. We have we have all the wording for it, microaggressions. We have all of those things. It's still racism. And they experience it every day because we have to understand they're taught in white institutions, in schools that are predominantly ran by white teachers, by white female teachers at that. And so when your kid, when your grandchild is coming home and telling you, you know, Miss Christy did not, you know, she doesn't call me when I raise my hand, but when little Johnny raises his hand, she calls him, or you know, she gave me this grade, and that's racism. But because they get to sit next to little Johnny, you know, they don't understand because their parents did not teach them that baby. That's racism. The difference between them and me is in my household, I told my son that's racism so that he knows when the teacher, when Miss Christie does something, that's her racism, and he has nothing at all to do with his abilities as a young black scholar because he's brilliant, but he had the language for it, and he had a word for it. And so when it happened to him, he didn't internalize it. But we see all the reason that we have all the school-to-prison pipeline, that's racism. The reason that you have all these resource officers in the school system that have a huge percentage of black boys being suspended, being expelled from school, having ADHD, labeling, and special education filled with black boys, that's racism. So they do experience it. It just looks different. because now we get to put all these little pretty words to it, and we do not, as black people, you know, want to own the fact that this country has not changed. And our children suffer every day in the school system through this racist system. So, yes, they still experience it. And I would dare say it's worse, because now they don't even have the benefit of coming home to a segregated community where they can be loved and nurtured. But, yeah, they experience it. They experience racism.
That's a very astute point that you made, Missy Tohan. I would add to that, as an educator, that's my background, and working in the systems, I have personally not only witnessed, but because of the job that I had, was forced to participate in actions that facilitated those type of actions that mm-hmm. led to racist acts towards black children and black families, and having to dissect that and having to explain it in a way. They lock in a system that's so tight, a family doesn't understand that they're being, they're experiencing prejudicial treatment until it's compared to another student that's white and the actions that student has demonstrated.
Absolutely. And
the language isn't there for that. The language is actually pushed aside. And mm-hmm. oftentimes in predominantly black communities, you have these actions going on. If you have predominantly black communities, you're going to have predominantly black staff members in these schools. And if the predominantly black staff are exhibiting these type of behaviors, then it doesn't look like racism because it's coming from your people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you have the cafeteria worker, the secretary, the teacher assistant, the lead teacher, the administrator, if they all look like you, it's not racism. That is what's being taught, right? That's also the argument that's happening right now with the unfortunate and traumatic situation in Memphis. Because the victim and the villain look the same, they don't want to identify it as racism.
But we have to understand, if you pledge allegiance to the systems of racism and white supremacists, I don't care if you're black or not, that is still racism. It's a system, and that's why I said it's important for us to understand these systems, right? Those cops in Memphis, right, Tennessee, pledged allegiance to the systems of racism and white, right, supremacy. Most black teachers in school system pledge allegiance to an act of systems of racism and white supremacy. Whether they know it or not, it still is, right, a pledge to uphold.
So with
system.
That being the understanding, would you say that we are contributing to our own trauma? Are we contributing with these acts, whether we're willing or unwilling? Are we contributing to our pain, our trauma?
Well, in order for one group to have power over the other, there has to be an unwilling participation of the powerless group, right? And so, yes, but I caution that, because one of the things that we do as black people is want to blame ourselves for our own oppression. We can't do that. We can't blame ourselves for our own oppression. No. The systems of racism and white people are to blame for our oppression, right? It's just that they are so clever, and it's been packaged so well, because we have to understand they are master manipulators. They are master manipulators, and they are masters at this craft. They have done a hell of a job in crafting this thing called racism and white supremacy. And in order for it to be to self-perpetuate, we have to participate in it, right? Because otherwise it's going to die. It's going to die off. The only way that you can maintain power over another group is if they participate and if they believe that they are powerless. And so that is our participation. We believe in the illusion of their power and the illusion of our powerlessness, right? Once we are able to understand that it's only an illusion, then the paradigm changes, which is why they do everything in their power to make sure that messaging and conditioning and social engineering goes on, happens daily in all facets of black life, like I said when I first started this, that every facet of black life is controlled by racism and white supremacy.
To get into your craft of healing and how you address these issues with families, to take us through a scenario when a black family is experiencing, witnessing their child being traumatized for what's happening in the schools. How do you help a family in that sense heal? What is the process that you go through? What does your company do to help with that family?
Yes, so that's such a good question. So I actually have two companies. One of them is Global Nubians, and Global Nubians is more revolutionary, much more aggressive, much more, you know, less about the spiritual healing and more about actually curriculum and naming the problem and naming what ails us. And then there's Healed and Fine, which deals with the spirit and healing the spirit and healing the self. So I'm going to say to you what I would do, what I do, and what I have done countless of times through Healed and Fine with my client is I have to let the family, the child know that, okay, this is what is happening. Okay, I have to be able to name it for the child, right? Name what is happening. Tell me what happened. Tell me how that made you feel, right? Okay, and this is why it's happening, because they see you, black child, as a black child. They are not connected to you. The things that are happening to you, the things that they're saying to you, it's not your problem. It does not mean that you are not a great black child. It is because of your greatness that that's why they're doing that to you. That's why they want to diminish your value and diminish your worth and diminish your life. And you have to understand that. And so I teach this black child particular tools and skills that when they encounter that, because it's going to happen for the rest of their lives, right, how they are able to circumvent that so they don't internalize it. Because we cannot change whiteness. I don't care how much we love white folks, they're not going to change. It's never going to change. What we can do is empower our children. And so that's what I set about doing with Healed and Fine, is let's talk about what is happening to you, black child. And let me tell you why it is happening. Understand that this what racism and white supremacy means. Understand what your teacher meant when he or she said that to you, right, in whatever scenario that is, right, and then give them tools to help them, to one, fortify them and love them up. Because I have to love my black babies. I love my black babies. Like, I have to fortify them with love and compassion and grace and history, right? Who are we as a people? Understand that the reason that these things are happening is because they understand who we are as a people. They understand our greatness. We don't understand who we are as a people, right?
Yes.
And because we don't understand who we are as a people, it is very possible. It makes it possible for people to tell you who you are if you don't know who you are.
Precisely.
So for me, when I work with children, I let them know who they are and let them also know that what is happening to them, it is not a reflection of who they are as a black child. It is a reflection of the system and the white person that is doing or saying those things to them, and then give them tools to empower them and to fortify them so that when they go to school the next day or the next week or the next year, they have tools. Now they're able to do this thing. Now they understand that they are war. It's a war. You know, sometimes we want to keep our kids, we always say, I just want to keep them innocent. Well, you know what? We can't do that. It's a war. It's a war, and you disempower your children if you don't let them know it's a war going on. Now, that doesn't mean that, and you have to have age-appropriate conversation with your children, right? You know, I think somebody else is trying to talk. I'm sorry. I'm going out.
No.
I'm not sure if I answered the question.
I go back to, very excellent points, but what I like to say, and I'm talking to two educators, not only yourself, but Sister Sice, and both of you guys are professional educators. Now, as professional educators, I can appreciate what you guys can teach, not only the kids, but even me. I go back to the times where we was never taught Black history. My first time taking a Black history course was when I was in college, and that's when I took my first Black history course. And, of course, from taking that Black history course from professionals like yourself, I became well-educated and informed. But my thing that I am concerned about is that you as educators and as African-American educators, you are not in the schools. They've taken you away intentionally from our kids. Like the national statistics are showing, only 10% of African Americans are educators in our educational system. So only 10%. So that means that the information that our kids are getting is not that intelligent information that I'm hearing right now from you educators. And again, our kids are not hearing it because they're not in front of Black teachers. So again, my point goes back to when they become adults and they've never been taught by professionals like yourself, they are just almost like just being lost in a system that is a system of hate to them, but they don't realize this hate, really realize it until they start living it, and that's when they become young adults. So again, you're absolutely right. We need to, when it comes to information, we need to be able to tell our own stories. But we can't tell our own stories because, again, you're not there to tell the story. There is a white school teacher telling that story. So how do we overcome a situation like that, and how do we be informative? Because usually after a person is around 18 years old, it's not the best time. They may not even want to take your advice or listen to what you have to say. So let me
answer that, if you can, Sister Itonga, let me answer that first. I think that's an excellent point that you bring up.
Yes.
Brother Bilal, excellent point. And I agree with you. We are not in the schools the way we used to be. And, again, that is intentional as well. The level of racism and the level of prejudice behavior that the teachers had to face. We were the ones who are on the same mindset as myself and our guest speaker, Ms. Itohana Basui, where we are empowered to teach our children in the classroom the truth. The systems censor us. Myself, I was a case manager in the special ed system, and I definitely identified with what was going on with the prison pipeline system. And it was my personal mission to educate every single parent through the process and advocate for them against the system, the system I was working for, advocated for them against the system to protect their boys, their children. They even attempted to put my son in that system, and I fought back. When people like us are present, there is a strong pushback for us to remain present. And, of course, we're adults who try to maintain a livelihood. So once we understand, okay, after being so many years in the system, that is going to continue to push back on me, push down on me, limit me, censor me, I need to move elsewhere in order to provide for my family to sustain my livelihood.
And this is intentional. What my parents did growing up, we grew up in multiple states. My father was in the military, so we traveled a lot. But we stayed in Maryland, Washington, D.C. area in the late 80s and 90s. And my parents were very instrumental in ensuring we learned our history. So they enrolled us in schools and after-school programs and community-based programs that taught that, that taught our history. And I would encourage parents to do the same with the understanding of you're not going to get the truth taught to your children in the schools today. I just saw a report now where they are the a school system in Missouri. The districts are paying teachers an extra $3,000 to teach patriotism, which is a fancy word for saying for white supremacy. They have taken cultural response, what was it called, critical race theory, i.e. black history, completely taken that out of the system by law and has replaced it by saying any teacher who is willing to teach patriotism as a curriculum, we will pay you an extra $3,000. That's how serious they are about erasing us. So I encourage parents of color to be aware of that and then take the time to teach your children outside of the schools. Take them to the community centers. Take them to the community collective. Take them to the households of those who are teaching this. Educate them because the knowledge is there. We're going to have to continue to do it in this manner because the system is not set up to provide not even adequate education for us. It's set up for us to receive inadequate education. Sister Itohan, do you want to add to that?
Absolutely. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, yes, by all means. Yes, we can still hear you, sisters.
Oh, are you in a dead zone? Is it still on?
You might have put it on mute.
Oh. Is that better?
Yes.
Yes, it's much better. We can hear
yes.
you.
Okay, I did have you guys on mute. Sorry about that. But Sister Sykes is so right because the things that have happened with black educators, you know, such vile things that have happened to black educators who are aware of the systems or who are aware of the injustices that are happening, most of them are silent. I, too, have worked in the school system, and I volunteered my entire child academic career. I was in the school system. I was that parent. I didn't work in the school system, but I volunteered almost daily. I made it my other full-time job when my son was in school. And so, yes, educators like me and Sajda, I've left the school system because we understand that it is almost impossible, if not totally impossible, to change the system from within. We have to enact our own institutions. There's just no way that we are going to get real education for our children in these school systems. They aren't. And so what I did as a parent when my child was going to school in the school system, one, I did what Sajda's parents did. I put my son in an African-centered school, lots of African-centered school. He also was preschooled and after-schooled when he got home from school. I made sure that I deprogrammed him from whatever nonsense he learned from the schoolhouse, right, understanding that, you know, their intention. And that's why I said it's really important that we have to understand the systems of racism and white supremacy. You're sending your kids to this white school. I don't care if it's a black teacher. I don't care what color the teacher is. They are teaching your child the ways of the oppressor. They are teaching your child how to be oppressed. They are teaching your child how to be a slave. I don't care who is doing it. That is their goal. And so you as a parent have to understand.
You have
to have curriculum at home to deprogram your child on a daily basis. So, yes, a lot of black educators are living the school systems because the black educators that are aware of what is happening and passionate about actually helping black people, black children, they are not allowed to do that in the school system. And this is why it's important to know this is a war. And the war is being fought, as most wars are fought, on multiple fronts. And the school system is one of the major, major fronts of the warfare on black people, right? So, yes, the black teachers are leaving the school system. So now that we know that that is a reality, what are we as black parents going to do to counter that? We can either set up our own independent schools and start teaching our kids African-centered information, you know, or we can deprogram them to after-schooling or preschooling or weekend schooling, such as like what other ethnic groups do. You have, like, Greek people. Their kids go to Greek weekend school to learn about Greek history and to learn the Greek language, you know what I'm saying? And all types of other people, they do that. So we have to be very serious-minded about the education of the black child. And so parents have to participate in this, because if you're sending your child to a public school, a private school, whatever type of school in this United States of America, if you're South African-centered, they are teaching your child how to be a slave and how to be oppressed and how to stay oppressed.
And it may start with healing and such the way of us bringing you here, sister, so we can learn how to heal and the process through that. One thing that we haven't touched on yet is contact information. Let the audience know how they can reach you and your services. What's the best way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So definitely healing through accountability, healing through knowledge, healing through what we know and what we have to understand is happening to us, and then we can have tools to heal so that as we engage in this white supremacist and this racist society, we have tools in which to engage, be empowered, and not defer, not acquiesce to this system. So my Instagram page is Healed and Fine. Healed as in healing, but with an E-D, H-E-A-L-E-D, and Fine, F-I-N-E, and I offer various healing services. You can, of course, consume my free content that I give. I talk about various issues that affect us as black people. We talk about meditation. We talk about saging and all of that stuff. But I will caution you, though, I'm not your typical healing facilitator. I just don't meditate and burn sage and think everything is going to be all right. Like, you're going to have to do some work, people, right? So I do that. I also do seminars and workshops and to empower you, to heal you. And I do one-on-one clients. It's my premium service. I do one-on-one clients. And I actually have a workshop that's coming up at the end of this month where we're going to be doing a healing circle. Dealing with healing and identifying emotional roadblocks and things like that. But this is my assignment, and what I do, the work I do, my assignment is to help to heal and elevate the consciousness of the global black citizen. So, yeah, Healed and Fine is my Instagram page, and you can contact me. And my email address is on there. You can contact me to either work with me one-on-one or stay tuned for the healing event that is coming anywhere near you.
Sister, I'd like to ask you, as far as your school, are you taking in adults also? Because, as you know, you and from my estimate, you take adults, I would say 40 years and younger. Many of them don't even know who Dr. Martin Luther King, and I use his name because it's like if you don't know his history, chances are your African-American history, you just don't know. And if you can't go back as early as Martin Luther King, you certainly cannot go as far back as Nat Turner and
some of those. You know nothing. Absolutely. Yeah. I work primarily with adults. Yeah, I work primarily with adults because you have to deprogram the parents and they can deprogram the child. Yeah. So that's who I work primarily with is adults. Yeah.
Excellent. And please, sister, become like you said, we have to tell our story. New African Black Belt Wall Street. The reason we've been on this, we started this radio broadcast some 8 years ago, is because Brother Aziz and I, years ago, was trying to find some way to get our information about, let's say, simply the struggle, what we're struggling for. So this broadcast is just one way of just saying a channel of communications where you can say what's really on your mind, and we can say it to each other. Because, like you were saying, there is no institutions out here that is willing to give us that type of power. So I would ask, but as we go along and have these discussions, we are finding the values of those in our communities all over the country as to where their values can make a difference. So your values, of course, you can see making a difference because of the large audience that you have listening to you. And the knowledge that many of us, including myself, were picking up. And then, of course, the questions that we can ask each other as to where we can all learn together. I would ask you to continue to be a part of. And, of course, we're going to support your school and any other charter schools, because that's what we're going to have to go to in order to teach our language, in order to say what we, and especially our educators, need to be said, is we have to have our own private schools. So I wish you all the best, but I ask that you continue to join in and become one of us. I thank Sister Sasha. Thanks so much for bringing on such a wonderful guest.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It was an honor. Thank you so much, Brother Bilal
and Brother Aziz, for accepting the guest of Missy Tohan Abusuyi. You have been a breath of fresh air for educating us and showing us how to heal and the process of healing. As we enter into Black History Month and with all the awareness and knowledge that we need. So we definitely salute you for that. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, brothers. Thank you, Brother Bilal. Thank you, Brother Aziz. And thank you, Sajda. It was an honor to be part of this conversation. This is what is needed for us to actually start healing. The conversation continues. I hope that the listening audience, you know, can take some nuggets from this and start today, start these conversations at home with your children and start deconstructing racism with your children, with your family, so that the next generation can be empowered and can be fortified and cannot internalize their own oppression. Thank you so much for having me again, guys. It was a pleasure. It was my pleasure.
Thank you again. Definitely. Thank you.
We'd like to greet our audience. Peace to you. Assalamu alaikum. And next Wednesday, we'll be right here to have a discussion again.
Thank you.
Have a good night, everyone.
Have a good
all
night.
Right.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
on the right.